The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Tonight, we reached the finish line of Who Killed WCW on Vice with Episode 4 airing at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Returning here to Post Wrestling to bookend our coverage of the series is Evan Husney. And here we are, Evan. WCW, the for sale sign is out on the grass, and that's what is going to be explored tonight on Episode 4, which I would say pretty consistently is the episode everyone has been looking the most forward to in terms of what new information may come out of this and the principles of Brad Siegel and Stu Snyder. But first of all, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And is that an Abdul the Butcher figure I'm seeing behind you there?
That is, it's a very rare Abdul the Butcher, very bloodied Abdul the Butcher figure, which might not be the most PC toy to be distributing of one Larry Shreve, but regardless, yes, a very good eye on your behalf.
I love that figure. I have one myself. Very happy to be back. Thank you so much. Episode 4, here we go. I'm a huge, I guess I was about to say I'm a huge fan of this episode, but I am. You know, we have so many amazingly talented people that work in our team and our staff, and I'm so indebted to them, you know, for getting this show put together. I mean, this was a very quick lift. I mean, we started filming this at the end of November, early December. Here we are, you know, in June, and the show is almost over. So it took a lot, you know, to get this show where it is. So I want to first thank everybody who works with us and to put this thing together. But episode 4, I'm very fired up about, because I think for me, for all the skepticism, I think a lot of the internet wrestling community had going into this series about, you know, oh, we've heard this all before, why are we rehashing this? I think this episode does a really good job of providing a lot of new information and new perspectives in terms of literally the final days of WCW, at least to me. I mean, this was a lot of stuff that I didn't know going in, and, you know, showcasing not only just the never before seen, you know, documentary footage of the last Nitro, which is amazing to see in this show, but just also the perspectives of everybody, you know, Eric Bischoff racing against time to try and save the company, WWE coming in, you know, maybe just some spooky, kooky stuff happening, you know, behind the scenes, some cloak and dagger. So, yeah, I think a lot of the people are going to be very excited to see this episode.
So we last had you on a couple of weeks ago, right before episode 1. Can you just tell me about, because I know at that time, like you were telling me, like episode 4 is not done yet. Tell me, like, as episode 1 is launching, what is still, like, this is not like you just sitting back and like you guys are still working on the series as it's happening in real time. So where were you, say, when the premiere happens as it relates to this episode we're going to see tonight?
We were probably pretty close to finishing everything, probably just getting it cut to time. You know, you have to be right on the second for broadcast cable. So I think we were probably shaving some time, getting it cut down and then doing color correction, sound mix and everything. But when we're doing seasons of Dark Side of the Ring, we are literally delivering these episodes sometimes 5 days before they hit the air. So sometimes, you know, in those 10 episode seasons of Dark Side, when the first episode hits, like we're very far from finishing the last few. So it's pretty stress and anxiety inducing that, you know, this is it. You have, there's no more time to be had. You know, you have to start committing to things and just, you know, locking it and pushing send.
So, and this is just one of the most like bizarre sets of, you know, timing and circumstances is that episode is going to be airing tonight. And this just comes days after the unfortunate passing of Jamie Kellner, who was the head of Turner Broadcasting. He is hired in March of 2001. And his first major move is removing professional wrestling from TBS and TNT. Just as somebody that, just your reaction on Saturday when this news comes out and any contact that was made with Jamie Kellner in the development of the series.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first and foremost, RIP, and, you know, send my condolences out to Jamie Kellner's family. I just remember reading Guy Evans' book, you know, well before we developed the series, and learning about Jamie Kellner and the final days of, you know, WCW, and him being brought in as sort of the new head of Turner Broadcasting. And of course, he'd be the one to actually physically pull the plug, canceling WCW from the Turner networks. I mean, it's completely surreal, just the timing on his passing to right before, you know, people are going to learn more about him on this show in the final episode of Who Killed WCW. But yes, many attempts were made to try and get Jamie in the show. And again, sort of picturing this series in my mind, and when we were developing it, it was like he was going to be a major key interview in my mind, as somebody we would finally get him, because he's on the record in Guy Evans' book, but getting him on the record in a documentary on television talking about this would have been great. One of our team members did reach out to him during the process of pre-production, and it took a long time for us to get a hold of him. I think we might have had to send like a physical letter through FedEx, you know, because couldn't find phone or email or any sort of internet communication with him. And his response, I think we did get him on the phone, and his response was basically like, I have no interest in talking about this again. I don't know if he said this. This is kind of more the sense that we got, was like, I can't believe I'm still having to talk about this, you know, so many years later.
But it was funny because I don't know if there's another on the record interview beyond the Nitro book that Jamie Kellner has done. And I think that there is like certainly like more nuance to like the way Jamie Kellner has been painted than comes out. Like I would think like a series like this would actually, you know, give him a voice.
I agree.
In terms of his story. Like I can understand some executives wanting to just, you know, not put their name attached to it, but we could certainly look at a Jamie Kellner that, would be someone that I think would be open to, you would think.
Totally. I just think it was probably more about just the hassle of doing the interview,
I guess,
and, you know, like cameras showing up and all that stuff, more so than actually talking about it. But, you know, I'm sure there's much more nuance. Again, you know, it's not like this company was, you know, doing gangbusters, you know, business at this time. And again, when something is trending downward as aggressively as WCW was at that time, it's kind of like, you know, you have to look at it like it'd be rolling the dice to re-kickstart it on Turner. You know, even with Eric, it's still a risk. And if the business has been trending that way for so long, and you have other, you know, as Eric calls in the show, you have this beachfront property, you know, prime time slots on these two networks that, you know, let's try something else in those slots. You know, we've done wrestling for this long, and I'm not a big fan of it, but it doesn't seem to be doing that well for us. And so that's sometimes how those executives look at things like this, very cold, zeros and ones. You know, hey, I've been, you know, part of conversations like that, or, you know, around decisions that have been made and, you know, in the landscape of TV that reflect a business decision much like that, you know, so, yeah.
Did you come into this series with, you know, a certain perspective on WCW's demise, and has that shifted through the interviews you've conducted, putting the series together? Are you coming out of this series with just a different point of view, or how has that shifted just throughout this several month process?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, talking to people firsthand and, you know, doing one-on-one interviews, of course, is going to give you, you know, more of a feeling and a context to everything than you would reading it in a book or hearing it in a documentary, of course. For me, there's been a lot of underappreciated things that to me have come to light more, which is, you know, I actually remember, like, as a kid, seeing Eric Bischoff sort of rise and then hearing him talk about his own story in documentaries soon after WCW's demise. I always was very inspired by sort of like his vision and his drive and his passion to sort of like, you know, take something and to have and to apply a new vision and have it be successful and, you know, try and take this thing and, you know, make it something different and all these intricate marketing decisions and intricate decisions that you make to make something, you know, like the NWO just take off. I've always been inspired by that sort of mindset. I think it might have even inspired me, you know, to jump into this world, you know, a little bit into the TV world. But for me, I think one thing that I didn't really appreciate as much before going into this that I did now was just like getting a clear, because a lot of, you know, wrestling fans and people who've heard the story a lot, they think about the booking decisions and they think about the, you know, the talent and who are we pushing and who aren't we pushing and the wrestling side of the story. I would hope that this series gives, and because as it did for me, more context to the business environment, the factor, the corporate factors that you're also up against. Not only are you having to manage the wrestling business side of everything, but you also have all these factors of people that are, you know, very skeptical of what you're doing. They, you know, would probably rather have it be something else on their networks, and you're having to constantly justify it. And, you know, when these arbitrary decisions are made and these arbitrary hirings are made with people that come in who are just like, you know what, you're going to have to market now towards children, you know, and you're going to have to make your show cater to a different audience. I've been, you know, again, in my career, just in my career, in a smaller scale, I've experienced, you know, arbitrary decisions and, you know, from the gatekeepers and rule makers. And those are very hard things to navigate. And you have to have a sharp mind to do that. And so I think I sort of walked away with a greater appreciation just for that whole aspect of the story. That's something that doesn't really get talked about as much.
How did you take, I don't know if you did the specific interviews with Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo, but at least like going through all of the footage, like for me watching this, it certainly seems to me like Eric Bischoff is somebody that, you know, he will, you know, rub people the wrong way on certain aspects. But I think in this kind of a setting, he's willing to look back with at least a good faith look at his wins and his losses and put them out there. I didn't so much get that sense from Vince Russo. Was it similar for you in that sense of, you know, people that are looking back on their own legacies? And that becomes very difficult to try and call balls and strikes when you're talking specifically about your reputations.
Yeah, I think that's keen. I think with Bischoff, my sense was that he really did sort of just the way he was approaching this interview. I was there for that interview, for both interviews.
Okay.
And just sort of, I just did get a sense that, okay, you know, that we were creating something definitive and he knew that. And that this was going to be a show that was going to maybe get more eyeballs than the usual wrestling documentary. And so I think he did want to approach it very honestly and with hindsight and looking back and, you know, taking responsibility for certain, you know, mishaps, but then also, you know, being proud of the things that did work, you know. Like, for example, I just remember, I don't think I'd ever heard in any of the other interviews that he had done, I don't think he had so freely admitted, yeah, I intentionally led the WCW audience to believe that Nash and Hall were coming in from the WWF. I think he'd always been kind of protective over fully admitting that, you know. Obviously there had been legal issues surrounding that and stuff, but still, that was cool to see, or to take responsibility, like, you know, for the David Arquette title thing, like, heck, you know, I approved it. I said, okay, I said it was a good idea. And hell, I even participated in it. So I think, you know, and then saying chronic, you know, WCW had chronic bad finish disease. So I think him, you know, looking at, with hindsight, in those sort of not so great decisions and taking some responsibility and being honest about them is good. But again, it's like, you know, it's his experience, right? You know, it's hard to be objective about your own experience, you know? And I think going back to what I was saying earlier, he more than anybody knows about the fight that he was fighting on the corporate side. And I think to have those other corporate voices in the show, like Dick Cheatham and Brad Siegel, sort of corroborate some of the things that Eric has been saying over the years, I know has been very vindicating for him. I think that is cool to see, that it just seemed like a different Eric, I think, we got than I've gotten even in some of the other interviews that we've done with Darkseid.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, Wei Ting and I are reviewing the Mr. McMahon series on Netflix with 6 straight days of reviews. The Double Shot will be coming back on Friday, September the 27th. We will be doing a free review of episode 1, and then episodes 2 through 6 will be covered exclusively for Post Wrestling Cafe members. Plus, this month, MCU Later is back covering Agatha All Along, and Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson have you covered for New Japan's Destruction in Kobe. PostWrestlingCafe.com. When you bring up like looking at these, you know, events objectively, was there a discussion going into this series of how were we going to assess, you know, the voices that were, you know, your reporters at the time, the people that were covering this in real time, whether to include them or not, whether it be your Wade Kellers, your Dave Meltzers, was that at all a discussion about their involvement as sort of like fact checkers along the way versus the people that were conveying their firsthand experience being in WCW?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to a just like kind of a creative preference, you know, on our own. Like sometimes we do with Dark Side have those voices in the show, especially if we can make them feel more like their characters in the series, more so than just a talking head. Mm-hmm. I think with this series, again, it's like, it's always, it's kind of a boring thing, but it's always a challenge. You know, you right at the start of the show, when you're putting everything together and you're mapping everything out, you only have so many shooting days and you only have so much money, and you have to make these difficult decisions in terms of, okay, you're given this much money, this many days, how are you going to carve this up? You know, in order to do all these interviews, get a well-rounded story, get enough voices, to, you know, diverse voices from different parts of the company, you know, top of the card, middle of the card, people from behind the scenes. And you have to make those choices. And you also have to make sure that those voices are going to give you enough, you know, coverage, if you will, for lack of a better term, over these 4 episodes. So, you know, if I could go back and make some different choices, maybe I would. And again, I know if we were given more time and money, I definitely know we would have interviewed, you know, a hell of a lot more people for this. I think one of the things that I look back in hindsight at this whole project is, man, we really could have done 2 more episodes. I think we could have done 6 episodes. And it's so hard to gauge that when you're doing it, especially, you know, when you're pitching it and others might be skeptical of how many legs does this one story have, you know, and you're obviously pitching this to people who don't know this story. And so you're having to justify all those decisions. But I think had we maybe pushed for 6, we probably could have gone deeper and maybe had a wider net in terms of getting more voices in it, you know, because that would have allowed us probably to spread around the shooting days a little bit more. But to answer your question, wait, what was your question?
You answered it sort of just like the philosophy of kind of utilizing, you know, people that were covering it at the time and kind of being those, you know, outside reporters.
Yeah. I have a lot of personal artistic opinions about like facts, you know, when it comes to documentaries. You know, for me, it's like, it might have been overkill beyond Guy. I knew I wanted Guy in the show, Guy Evans, of course, who wrote the Nitro book, because I felt like having a really objective voice, you know, because a lot of the sort of newsletter voices, you know, within wrestling, it's hard for them to be objective now. And I've noticed that over the years because, you know, a lot of people don't get along with one another. You might know what I'm talking about. But with Guy, I felt like he could be really objective. And because he wrote the book, and I think he just brings information that the audience might need to know. You know, here's what an audience who's not a wrestling audience might need to know to understand this story. And it's sort of a decoder ring for some of those more complicated details that only us, you know, fans really can understand on a shorthand. But then again, for me to use like 2 more, 3 more slots, you know, on more newsletter voices, it might have been tough, because then it would have mean I would have had less of the voices of the people who are actually there, which, you know, Jason and I making these shows, we always prefer. If that makes sense.
Yes. With all the interviews that you have conducted, I'm sure you guys are sitting on just hours of unused footage. It always becomes a question whether you watch, you know, an episode of Dark Side of the Ring. Is there any thought to, like, what do we do with, like, say, a multiple hour interview with like a Brad Siegel, for instance, is there any thought to will you find any kind of outlet? Because, like, you know firsthand that a wrestling audience, like, there is a lot of people that would just devour something like that for a rare interview with a Brad Siegel or a Stu Snyder, for instance.
Absolutely. It's very funny you bring this up. So going into season 5 of Dark Side of the Ring, we probably could have done a better job getting the word out there. But what we did is we launched a podcast called Dark Side of the Ring Unheard with me and Jack and JP from The Lapsed Fan.
Right.
And the sort of I actually crunched the numbers. I like did the math around how many hours of documentary footage we've actually shot for Dark Side of the Ring. And the number escapes me right now, but it's like well over 400 hours. It's like some insane number of footage that we have. And then I also found out that maybe only 2 or 3% of that has ever been used. I know it's so extreme. So what we thought is that it would be fun to do a podcast where we can sample some of the, you know, things that people haven't heard before in any of the shows. And that's what we do on the podcast. We sort of set it up and set up the sound bite, and then we hear the unaired sound bite from a particular subject and we sort of dissect it. It's a very fun show. And we're definitely going to be doing that for this at some point. I'm not sure exactly when, but we'll probably do a Who Killed WCW run where we go through some of the other interviews and look at some of the unused material, because there is a lot. Not everything's gold. You know, of course, there's a lot of filler in terms of, you know, we ask a lot of, you know, very detailed questions about setup and make sure people can, you know, non-fans can understand things. But there is some nuggets in there. And so I'm sure we'll find a time to, you know, spotlight those on that podcast at some point.
Well, we are going into episode 4 tonight, so that's going to tackle the entire sale and even going beyond March of 2001, as you will go a little bit into the invasion, which I'm certain you could you could probably squeeze quite a few episodes just out of the invasion alone. But that's all coming up tonight, and I think everyone will be focused on the comments from Brad Siegel and Stu Snyder, among others, who are featured, and the footage that I can't believe this camcorder footage was in someone's possession for over 20 years, which is pretty revealing. Like you have these performers that are being shot on camera just backstage, and you can tell like the F's to give are gone. They just like are. In like what is going on here, and not shy about sharing their feelings right on camera.
Yeah, at the time, you mean, like in that footage?
Yes, yes, at that time in 2001.
Yeah, it's man, that footage. I was just saying this earlier today. It's like this project, I don't think would be half of what it is, you know, without that footage. I think the fact that this footage that it actually came to us late in the game too. It came to us like, I want to say maybe in February, it came to us, and, you know, we're well under the way of editing and it was like, oh man, this is going to change everything. You know, it definitely did for episode 4. And, but I actually remember when it arrived, I went through every frame of it, making my, you know, personal selects of the cool things I was able to find. And it was just so illuminating because it's amazing that it exists. But it also just so it captures a mood. It captures the atmosphere in Panama City of just the uncertainty of the future. You know, because something that you have to, I think people have to understand, something I didn't understand until seeing this footage and also doing some of the interviews, is that there were some people that knew that WWE, you know, was going to buy this company and that was what was going to happen. But nobody knew. I'm talking about people who were working for Turner and for WCW. More specifically WCW, like all the, you know, stage hands, the production designers, the makeup artists, the crew, the camera people, the people who've been working for this company for probably 20 years, they had no idea what their future was going to be. They had no idea if, you know, WWE is going to keep WCW afloat and, you know, Nitro is going to be on the air next week, or it's going to be, you know, we're just going to, you know, we just own it now, but we're going to keep it going, or if everything's going to be, you know, consolidated into one brand, and are they going to have jobs? So people weren't told very much, you know, going into that day. And I think that level of sort of uncertainty and that just that mood is very present and palpable in that footage. And that was very almost eerie to me. And then, of course, you do see a lot of those people, the wrestlers and the people behind the scenes, the technicians, you know, sort of saying like, you know, you don't want to know my real feelings on this. I think it's a bunch of bullshit, you know, or whatever. So it's cool to see that. And it's, again, I don't want to spoil too much, but like, I actually remember seeing that clip that's in the fourth episode of Dustin Rhodes. You know, he's there and he gets the format for the show. And you see the footage of him being handed the format and he reads the format and it opens with Vince McMahon vignette, you know, and just the surreal nature of that in the context of this Monday Night War and everything. It's pretty cool to see that.
Well, Evan, congratulations on the series, and thanks a lot for jumping on with us. Who Killed WCW, Episode 4, tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV in Canada. You can watch it on Crave, and I'm sure we will be knocking on your door down the road,
yes.
Evan, about whatever is on tap in the very, very busy world of one Evan Husney. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, man. Take care. Thank you.